World Sheet Scotch Ring, EDS-EFT. So just to start with a kind of vague motivation, I'm sure maybe familiar to many of you, it's no harm in boring you a little just to set up some context. So recently there's been a good deal of progress in studying the conjectured ADS-CFT duality, in particular by comparing the energies of semi-classical string solutions with the anomalous dimensions of gauge invariant operators. And a lot of the progress has been made has been in considering particular solutions, spinning strings, strings with large angular momentum, large spin, which is a convenient way of going about it because the classic, even just the classical theory is particularly complicated. It's hard to solve exactly, so far hasn't been proved to be possible to solve exactly. And so by considering particular solutions, there's been a good deal of progress. But it has been noticed that the theory is, well, probably integrable. At least the world sheet theory is classically integrable, even for the full superstring. And there's reasonable, or there's some evidence that this integrability persists into the quantum theory. And it has been pointed out that in the dual gauge theory, there's also an integrability. There's a hidden sort of two dimensions that allows us to have an integrable description of anomalous dimensions. And this leads to a number of powerful tools. Integrable systems are about as simple as you could hope for without being trivial. And so there's, over the years, there's been a large amount of tools which have been developed for studying these. In particular, and one that kind of motivates the next step to look at the S-matrix is the beta ansatz. And a key element of the beta ansatz, or the key element, is to study the S-matrix of the theory. And so that's exactly what I want to do. I want to try and study the S-matrix of the world sheet scattering in a sort of perturbative calculation. And there's been a good deal of progress in actually finding what the full exact S-matrix is, which should give us the exact anomalous dimensions of all what you call gauge invariant. Well, okay, so there's a couple of things, of course, that all of these planes kind of sound grand, but one thing is we're going to be focusing strictly on the planar limit. So it's always in the planar limit, and also we will be considering sort of large operators. The exact theory should include finite length information, but this remains sort of an issue of, it remains a large issue. This is one of the kind of remaining outstanding problems is to try and understand what the finite length corrections are. However, with those caveats, which I'll explain a little bit more as we get into the talk, the S-matrix, these exact S-matrices should give us the exact anomalous dimensions of single trace operators. So there's been a number of different ways of trying to calculate these things by using symmetries, by using this generalized crossing, and so on, and just various conjectures. And while obviously getting the full answer is of course the goal, it's nice to have a way to test these conjectures, and that's the motivation for the work that I'll describe, is that we want to try and actually use perturbative results to check these conjectures. And it's based on work of my collaborators, Thomas Close, Rafa Weiban, and Constantine de Rembo, and some work that's in progress. So just to give an outline of what I'll talk about, I'll bore you a little bit by sort of reviewing what the green short string is on the super coset space of ADS5 and Z5, including all the symmetries. And then I'll talk a little bit about finding the light cone action. This is the key thing. We want to consider only physical excitations, so we want to choose a physical gauge. And so we'll choose a light cone type of gauge. Actually, the different gauges will form a little bit of an issue, in and I'll try and explain how that arises and what the point is in looking at different gauges. So after that, once we do calculate what our light cone gauges, we want to do just normal perturbation theory, and I'll try and describe the calculation of the S matrix in orders of inverse powers of lambda. Basically, I'll be talking about the tree-level S-matrix in light cone gauge. And I'll even at tree level, we'll see that a lot of issues that are very somewhat subtle will arise. And in particular, the S-matrix, of course, should reflect all of the underlying symmetries of the theory. And however, just this issue of symmetries, the fact that the S-matrix won't naively commute with what we think are the symmetries, which is a little bit confusing, and I'll point out how that sort of puzzle is resolved. In particular, we find this appearance of this non-trivial coproduct. There's sort of a hop algebra structure to the underlying theory. And we'll see how this then also matches with the description of the spin chain description of the Joule-Yang-Mills theory. I'll show how the symmetries arise and how the structure similar to this non-trivial coproduct also arises. And then if there's time at the end, I'll try and talk about pushing this to include loop corrections. And obviously, this is the thing. You want to go to higher and higher loops so that we have a more complete description. But this gets complicated. And I'll try and explain kind of partial work in calculating the four-point function of one loop. And we'll see that we run across some unexpected divergences, which are somewhat problematic. And it's hard to interpret them. And so in order to try and understand a little bit better what their origin might be, I will talk about how we can consider the one-loop effective action of the sigma model on the supergroup manifold. This sort of acts as sort of a toy model for the full problem. And in this case, you get a perfectly finite answer, and then it might point out some possible ways forward. However, this work is work in progress, and if there isn't time at the end, I will skip it. But I'm happy to discuss it with anyone who has any ideas. And I have some other comments that in recent work there have been some simplifications, some other sort of toy models, not just the sigma model on the supergroup, but some other sort of simplifying approximations where you can actually get proper one-loop information. In that case, you always seem to do a little bit better. Okay. So just very, very quickly, this should be also very familiar. This is the ADS5 times S5 geometry, sort of a little toy Mathematica picture of two directions. This is the ADS5 space with the radial direction, and here's the sphere. And in particular, in some sense, I'm going to focus on the light cone gauge and expand around and expand in just powers of fields. But this is essentially equivalent to choosing a classical solution, imposing some of the equations of motion, and then expanding in powers of fluctuations about that classical solution. And the classical solution to which this is equivalent is simply just the BMN string. It's a point-like string moving around one of the geodesics of this S2 inside the flight sphere. Obviously, the symmetries of the group are just the normal bosonic symmetries of the conformal group SO4.2. And then there's the symmetries of the 5-sphere, which is SO6. And of course, this is a maximally supersymmetric space. So we can combine this into the full supergroup, which is PSU2.2 bar 4, the well-known total symmetries of this space, and great advertising for Penn State. So the string action in this background, so it's nonlinear. Quantization has proved very difficult. In particular, when you include the fermions, you need to use a Green-Schwarz description. Quantization of the Green-Schwarz superstring is famously difficult, and even in flat space, proves very complicated, and you can't really do it in many gauges. So it's only tractable in certain limits. In particular, as I said, when expanding about certain classical solutions, such as the spinning string solutions of Frohlich and Seidlin, or the fast point-like strings moving on a geodesic, the solution of BMN. However, the target space can be described as a super coset space because it's maximally symmetric. You can actually describe the space as homogeneous symmetric space. And so you can actually, this gives you a reasonably simple description, a relatively simple description of the geometry. And in particular, you can actually solve for the super field line in terms of the fermionic coordinates. And then furthermore, this action is classically integrable. It has an infinite number of higher conserved currents, which gives us the hope that actually the theory might indeed be solvable. So this is the somewhat messy looking action. So here is the Metzev-Seidlin action written in terms of the superfield bind, and here are the superfield bind given in their expressions in terms of the world sheet fermionic coordinate. So the bosonic field bind just has the normal bosonic leading part, and then it has a supersymmetric completion. The thetas are these fermionic coordinates, and there's some quadratic expression in terms of 10-dimensional gamma matrices and fermionic coordinates. And then this is the covariant derivative, which couples the fermions to the background curvature and to the phi-form flux, which also exists in this geometry. Okay. So as I said, the key step in actually calculating what we want, so the thing we want to find is the physical S matrix, the S matrix for scattering physical excitations. And in order to do that, we need to choose a physical gauge. And this then leads us to gauge fixing the oral sheet action. So there's a reasonable number of issues involved in this. And I'll try and outline a little of some of them without getting too much into the actual equations, which end up being sort of ugly looking and perhaps not terribly enlightening. However, that being said, the procedure is in some sense just canonical. It's very straightforward. We introduce target space light cone coordinates, and we make a gauge choice such that we choose the whirl sheet time tau to be equal to one of our light cone directions, x plus. We also choose that the light cone momentum is uniformly distributed just along the string. And we choose a kappa gauge, a kappa symmetry gauge. The Green-Schwarz string has this well-known additional fermionic symmetry. It has a kappa symmetry. And so we can choose half of, we can set half of our fermions to be zero. And so we just choose a kappa gauge such that gamma plus, this is the light cone combination of the 10-dimensional gamma matrices. This is an axis of projection operator. So the fermions that are projected by gamma plus are just set to zero. Then we remove x minus using, we have the constraint equations, just follow from the whirl sheet metric, the Virasoro constraints. We can use these constraint equations to remove the remaining conjugate, or the removing longitudinal degree of freedom, x minus. But actually, one particular thing that's important here is that the constraint equations really only give us equations for the derivatives of x minus. They don't determine the zero mode, and this is, in some sense, one of the sources of the complications, and sort of the origin of this top algebra structure that arises. In some sense, it's just a consequence of the gauge. And the fact that the constraint equations only determine derivatives of x minus. Then we have to choose that our gauge is obviously consistent in flat space. You know that light cone gauge is going to be, you can show that it's consistent. But here we have to be a little bit more careful, and we have to ensure that we determine our whirl sheet metric consistently with the x minus equation of motion and our gauge choice. And we can calculate the light cone Hamiltonian. It's just the momentum in the x plus direction. So it's just the longitudinal momentum. And we express it in terms of the transverse physical fields here, the momenta pi, the derivatives, and fermionic coordinates. It's important. It's useful in order to make a redefinition of the fermions to just introduce new fermionic fields, which are combinations of the old fermionic fields, such that they have canonical Poisson brackets. And this makes quantization, make perturbation theory a little bit more straightforward. But it just corresponds to making a redefinition of your fermionic fields. And making redefinitions of fields, in the end, while it will change the S matrix, shouldn't actually affect the spectrum at all. And of course, it's only the spectrum in the end that we're particularly interested in. And then, of course, we just Legendre transform to find the light cone Lagrangian, and we expand in powers of lambda, or inverse powers of the string tension. Now, that's sort of the standard procedure for finding the light cone Lagrangian. There's a couple of alternate methods, which in some sense are more efficient, because we need to calculate off sometimes higher powers of these things. And as I said, the expressions are somewhat complicated. And then additionally, it's never exactly clear, well, as I said, that your symmetries are being correctly manifested by the gauge choice. It's not clear that these gauge choices you're imposing in a classical fashion. You're using the classical equations of motion. And you need to be careful that the gauge choice is consistent when you want to include quantum effects. And so it's useful to have several different methods for calculating what the actual light cone Lagrangian is. And as you can actually see just two alternate methods are one just imposing the gauge fixing directly on the light cone Lagrangian and then Legendre transforming in the longitudinal degrees. Or a second approach is you can actually t-dualize in the x minus direction. You can then choose a gauge where you set the whirl sheet time to be equal to the space time, and you will allow the string to just lie along your dualized x minus direction. You can now impose the appropriate kappa gauge. You can integrate out the whirl sheet action, which gives you sort of the square root NAMU like action, plus the kind of like normal less amino term, and then you can expand in pairs of fields. So both of these alternate methods of deriving the Lycoln Lagrangian give you the same bosonic expression, as I said, that you've got the bosonic coordinates, the fermionic coordinates, and both of these give you the same answer. However, the fermions end up being slightly different, and presumably the two methods are related by just a field redefinition. Although this is not necessarily in finding the actual redefinition is. Well, it hasn't been possible, and so it's not necessarily clear which exactly the right which the right Lagrangian to use is. However, in what follows, I'll use the previous method where you actually go through the Hamiltonian expression. And often it seems that the correct choice is to actually do this, is to find your Lycoln Hamiltonian and then to find the Lycoln Lagrangian. And this seems to be the most sensible method. And then DPLC gives the right answers. Okay. So it's also important just to explain a little bit about what I mean by the different gauge choices, because this will, as we'll see, the S matrix itself is not a gauge invariant operator. Indeed, it's only the spectrum, when you actually want to compare the energies of strings against the anomalous dimensions of operators, that you should find gauge invariant quantities. So it's important to explain what the actual limits that we're interested in and what the actual the different gauge choices correspond to. So in particular, we'll use an interpolating gauge. So this interpolates between sort of like a static light gauge and a proper light cone light gauge, where the light cone momentum is some linear combination of the target space energy and the target space angular momentum, J. And A is this sort of, you know, interpolating parameter. So two particular choices, if we choose the Lycoln momentum to be actually equal to the angular momentum, then we'll find that this is the particular gauge choice that agrees most closely with what you calculate in the gauge theory spin chain description, and in some sense matches the S matrix originally conjectured by Ruggiero, Frohloff, and Staudacker. A simpler choice, however, one that just makes the equations a little bit simpler, is the so-called uniform gauge, where P minus is equal to E plus J. And in this case, the expressions come out a little bit simpler, and it's more straightforward to do the calculations. But of course, the S matrix looks different. But as I said, in the end, when you actually calculate physical quantities, you should get the, and indeed you do, you get the same answer. So as I said, the actual, the expansion parameters, it's a little bit subtle about how you're exactly doing this. I see one of my equations seems to have moved off the side. So the gauge choice fixes the string length. In choosing your gauge choices, you fix the string length such that the string length J is proportional to the world sheet, is proportional to the target space Lycoln momentum P minus, with the constant proportionality being this 2 pi over the square root of lambda. Now, obviously, to calculate the S matrix, we need to have, you know, so the string, of course, is defined initially as a cylinder, but to calculate an S matrix, you have to be able to define, you know, asymptotia. So we take the world sheet length to be infinity and take sort of a decompactifying limit of the world sheet. And so we take J to be infinity. And then what happens is this 2 pi over the square root lambda just ends up being our loop. However, you can actually show, and in some sense, sometimes it's easier to consider the actual limit to be, you can rescale all of your world sheet coordinates by this vector string tension, and now the string length is not is simply p minus, which you can then take to infinity. So you take the target space momentum that's kind of uniformly distributed along your string to be infinity, and you can now take small momentum expansions, and you'll see that at least at tree level, these two expansions are indeed equivalent. They should. All right. So once we do fix our gauge choice and we remove our longitudinal degrees of freedom and all our extraneous fermions and whatnot, we're left with the physical fields, which actually form a bifundamental representation of PS 2 bar 2 squared. And so here are the physical fields, which I'll interested in sort of scattering. We have the Ys, which come from the sphere, the Zs, which come from the ADS, and then we have the fermions. And in some sense, the remaining supersymmetries, which lie in this supergroup square, they act along the sort of the horizontal and the vertical, taking these bosons into these fermions. And I've taken this sort of two-index notation, with the bosons being a dot, and the Zs being alpha dot, fermions being sort of So if you can, my point is essentially, if you can assign a grading to the A's and the alphas such that the Z's and the Y's are bosons and the alpha, the psi's and the epsilons are fermion. The scattering matrix is acts just on a tensor product of this SU 2 bar 2 module square, and we're just interested in taking two particle states into two particle states. So this is basically the setup, and now that we have this, we have a couple of expectations. Like I said, the theory is essentially is meant to be integrable. Now, the integrability, as I said, the infinite number of conserved charges was constructed in covariant gauges. However, even though we've gone to Lycombe gauge, we still expect that integrability has been preserved. In some sense, all we've done is we're expanding about a classical solution where we've imposed some of the equations of motion. But none of these things should stop the conserved charges from being conserved, for example. So we have a number of expectations. First of all, given that the theory is integrable, we expect that the S matrix should satisfy this sort of splitting that we find in the representation of the physical fields. Essentially, the S matrix should split into the tensor product, two S matrices, one for each of these groups. There should be no particle production. This is sort of the fundamental, or one of the most trivial ways of saying what we mean by integrability. There should be no particle production. We only need to know what the two particle, the two goes to two scattering matrix is. Furthermore, once we know the two-particle S matrix, all multi-particle scatterings should just be products of the two-particle S matrix. So essentially, the multi-particle S matrix should factorize into products of two-particle S matrices, and the consistency condition for this to be true is that the S matrix should satisfy the Young-Baxter equation, which just basically...
Is this obvious, the first condition that you said that it splits the two factors?
Yes. Is it obvious? No, in fact, in some sense, this is actually a consequence of integrability. For a generic S matrix, this wouldn't be the case. It's not obvious. In some what it is a consequence of is that for integrable systems, you can write down, say, the Fatih Zamolodchikov algebra with the operations which can construct the states, and then you can see that the symmetries should be realized on those creation operators, and from those, then you can see that the S matrix should split into this tensor. So yes, absolutely, it's not a trivial statement. Okay, so indeed, yes, so it should satisfy the Young-Baxter equation, and so these are sort of, the S matrix should be consistent with the symmetries. I should say, in Lycombe gauge, when you actually do write down the action, and I haven't here, although maybe I'll show you this later, the symmetries are by no means manifest. The only symmetries that you actually have manifest are SU2 to the fourth, which in some sense are manifest just from the way of combining the fields. The rest of, in particular, the supersymmetries are realized in a sort of very complicated fashion. So it's important to check that the symmetries are actually, that the S matrix is consistent with these symmetries. So at least initially, and I'll just talk about the tree-level calculation. Right? So we'll just calculate the classical T matrix, and then I will also factor out a kind of kinematical factor. This just comes from the fact that when you write down the two-particle, the two-dimensional delta function, you get sort of a Jacobian, which gives us this overall factor, where epsilon is the excitation energy and P is the excitation momentum. Okay.
Usually when you get the one has to show that the symmetries that are non-linear realized. So usually when you pick the light cone, there are some symmetries that are manifest and some are not.
Right.
So can one sort of show, in flat space, one of the things the Green and Schwarz did was to show that the theorist won't get invalid.
Right, okay. So actually showing that explicitly is it's very complicated. And so we can't do it. What I can do is I can do it sort of perturbatively, order by order. And in some sense, that's what I'll be doing here. I'll show that the S matrix is consistent. But you can write down what the all-order expressions are, but you can't show that they're realized consistently quantum mechanically to all orders except. So this is in some sense, like a step. But and this is the thing, that it's different than flat space in a very key way. And that's one of the things that I'll try and talk about. Okay, so the T matrix, as I said, should also factorize in the same fashion and should satisfy the classical Young-Baxter equation. So, as I said, we have the manifest SU2 to the fourth symmetries, so we can write the T matrices in terms of sort of 10 coefficients, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, K, whatever. Okay, so and then you can calculate the T matrix, you can take its commutator with the symmetries, and you can quickly check that it doesn't commute with the global with the symmetries, the GSU two symmetries. And so then I'm going to talk about how this is resolved. So there's a couple of things. There's essentially two issues. One, there are additional central charges which were not not obvious from the beginning, and the charges, the global charges that do correspond to the sort of the target space symmetries are non-local in Lightcone gauge, and in this sense they have a non-trivial coprop.
Sorry, do those T's, does that general form satisfy the Young-Baxter equation, or do it further constraints on those coefficients?
It's not yet. There's further constraints on the coefficients. So the first thing, the existence of these additional central charges, which was pointed out before by Bicert in the spin chain description, and by AFPZ, where they constructed them in the world sheet theory. In the gauge theory, they have this sort of very peculiar, they're sort of added in by hand, for a reason which I'll try and mention when I get there. But from the world sheet point of view, in some sense, these additional central charges are trivial. We've chosen a Lightcone gauge, and we've gauge fixed, and so the fact that we then want to check that the nodular charges satisfy the appropriate algebra, but you only expect that the algebra should be satisfied up to the constraints. Or if you have completely gauge fixed theory, you would only expect that the algebra would be closed up to compensating gauge transformations. This is the thing that when you perform some of these transformations, they'll take you out of the gauge slice that you chose, and so you have to take a compensating gauge transformation. In particular, if we take two of the nodular charges corresponding to the supersymmetries, and we calculate their anti-commutator, we just find we get a term which is proportional to the interval of pi x prime and the corresponding term for the fermions. And this is just the level matching condition, right? This is just basically, and this is the fact that we haven't imposed level matching on our Lagrangian. We imposed it on our states, and so we only expect the algebra should close up to this constraint. However, this also has a slightly different interpretation, is that if you act on it on a state which has momenta, it will basically be proportional to the momentum of the state. This is essentially its level matching condition, which says that the total momentum of a string should be on a closed string should be zero. However, we'll be interested, if you're just considering a single excitation, its momentum is not necessarily zero, and so you'll just find that this basically just pulls out the momentum of a single excitation. And this was exactly the type of the additional central charges that were added into the gauge theory. They're just related to the momentum of individual excitations. And indeed, if you evaluate these additional central charges on actual physical fields, they should be zero. And of course, indeed they are. Okay, so that's that. I just want to point out this is a little bit useful. This expression, this level matching condition, is related by the constraint equations to the spatial derivative of x minus. Okay. So the second thing is this non-trivial braiding, and in particular the non-trivial braiding for the global charge. In two dimensions, in one-dimensional or one plus one-dimensional field theory, it's quite standard to have non-trivial braiding. In fact, this is one of the ways that it's consistent to have an infinite number of higher conserved charges, which you might naively think is in violation of the Kolmogorov-Dula theorem. However, one of the assumptions that goes into that theorem is that the charges have to act by satisfying a normal Leibniz rule, and in integral theories, the non-local charges indeed don't. So, just to explain what this braiding is, so essentially if we have the product of some current on some field in our theory, and we want to take the current past the field where we have some sort of implicit time ordering with fields which are to the left later than fields to the right, we find that if we want to reorder them, and when the fields are mutually non-local, we get this non-trivial braiding. And just to sort of give a hand-waving argument or sort of this sort of contour argument, if we just consider the fields that we normally find in principal chiral models, where we find, say, the first non-local charge, which is, so J1 are just the underlying, Lie charges, or the Lie algebra currents corresponding to the Lie algebra charges. We can construct the first bilocal charge by this sort of recursive method where it involves this chi, where chi is the integral of one of the currents along some contour gamma. So essentially, if I want to consider the product of two fields, where I have my field phi, and I have my current j, and as I said, in order to define this current, I have to pick some contour. I'm sorry, I've actually chosen for labeling. The contour here are called cx. Like cx is just the contour that defines this non-local charge. And so here I have that the time of the current is later, so the contour lies above, so I have time ordering running upwards. If I want to reorganize them, I have to deform the contour, you know, so that it lies in the past of the field, but I can't just deform the contour past the insertion corresponding to my field, so I have to do this simple contour manipulation where I take a contour around the insertion and I can define a new contour. And essentially, this little contour argument, so this integral here, where I take I integrate the current around the insertion, just defines the action of the charge corresponding to this current on this field. So this is the definition of what I mean by the acting of the charge on the field, essentially this contour here. And then this reduces, if J is local, is mutually local with the field, this will reduce to the normal commutator. And so this contour argument here is just simply saying that the braiding relation of the first non-local charge with my field just gives me this sort of standard relation. So here, this is sort of the standard argument we get in just two-dimensional integral models. Admittedly, somewhat hand-wavy. I mean, you have to be careful about defining these things properly and taking commutators and whatnot. However, we can do exactly the same thing in the case at hand. The slight difference is that unlike in the in normal principal chiral models, because of our gauge fixing, there's actually a non-locality in the actual definition of our global nodular charges corresponding to supersymmetries, corresponding to target space supersymmetries. In particular, if we look at what their exact expression is, you can just again, given that the space is a super coset space, you can find sort of their exact expression. And it involves this e to the I x minus. And this e to the I x minus, in order to define x minus, we have to pick a contour. We essentially, to define x minus, we integrate x minus prime along some contour coming in from minus infinity. And we can also then, given that x minus is related to sort of the level matching condition, we can just calculate what the canonical Poisson bracket is with any of our fields, and essentially we just find that it just takes the derivative of the field. And so we can then, given that we have the Poisson bracket and the definition of the currents, doing this sort of similar contour argument from before, deforming the contour, we can find what the braiding is with our charges with any of our fields. And the key thing is that we find that the currents and the fields have this non-trivial braiding, which is essentially related to the momentum of fields. You can then find what the action of the charges is on a field. Just by again. So here, to define the action of the charge, I integrate the current along some contour, but the current itself has a contour in its definition, and so to find what the action of the charge is on the field, we again, sort of contour argument, where we can find what the action of the charge is. And the important thing is that it no longer acts by sort of a simple commutator. Here on this side, the q's are just the currents integrated along a constant time slice. So here I'm just integrating the current. So to get the charge, I just integrate the current along a constant time slice. So the important thing, though, is that given the non-locality involved with the current, and so that I can't deform this contour trivially, I get this non-trivial braiding. Okay. So as I said, that's perhaps a little bit hand-wavy, but the important thing is that you find this non-trivial braiding, which can sort of be summarized in the fact that there's a non-trivial coproduct. So if we want to find what the action of our charges is on the tensor product of states, we find that it doesn't act by just the simple Leibniz rule. Indeed, we have this e to the I, if we go to momentum space, this is just e to the I p over 2. Okay. And if this only occurs for the supersymmetries, if we look at the bosonic charges, they do indeed satisfy the normal Leibniz rule. And all the supersymmetries have this sort of non-trivial braiding. This is it's very closely related to what you find on the gauge theory, where you also find a non-trivial coproduct. There, though, it's a little bit different because if you've chosen a different set of basis states. However, you can sort of take this formal field redefinition where you absorb one of, I'll explain a little bit what I mean by this again in in a few slides, where you take one of your vacuum scalars, Z, and you sort of define new excitations where they involve sort of the square root of a field. And if you make this formal definition change of basis, you find exactly the same co-product. Without making this definition, you find the co-product, which is somewhat different. Nonetheless, every choice results in a non-trivial co-product. It's just to find the exact matching you need to make this the free definition. Okay. Yes, so one of the particular things about the spin chain description for the full theory is that you have these length-changing operators. So you're basically, you're considering single-trace states, and you consider, you know, you have some vacuum of like some particular scalar, so some chiral primary, so we call, say, the vacuum scalar Z, and then your excitations correspond to other types of fields. Well, one of the things is that you have this sort of spin chain description with each kind of field in your single trace being the lattice site, and the lattice seems to be able to change length. And this is a particularly novel feature from the spin chain description, but also something that would be very hard to realize from a worldsheet point of view, where you have a string length that is just some length, that the string length doesn't change. In some sense, this length changing fact that you find on the spin chain description is indeed just related to this non-trivial co-product. The length changing operators, which are these z plus or minus, are related to this e to the I x minus. And it's this e to the ix minus that corresponds to this length-changing, that corresponds to this non-trivial co-product. Okay, this Hopf algebra structure, so here I've just basically outlined how you would find the non-trivial co-product. To find the full Hopf algebra structure, you can just pick a sort of canonical co-unit and unit and define normal multiplication. And then given that if you do this, there's actually a sort of a standard choice for the antiput. This is just to sort of fill in the actual normal definitions that you need for Hopf algebra structure, which is perhaps one of the most interesting things to have found in this description. But I actually won't have too much more to say about it, but it's obviously something that's interesting for the future. Okay.
Can you summarize the definition of the Hopf algebra?
Yeah, I guess. For a Hopf algebra, you need to have a co-product. You need to have
what is a co-product?
A co-product is just so you have some algebra of operators, and you need to define the definition for taking the algebra to act on tensor products of states. So it takes you from the algebra to the. I'm not gonna get the definition right, but so the co-product basically is the rule for acting on tensor products of states. And so in addition to that, you need the...
But you allow the generalization of the lattice.
Right, so Hopf algebra allows you for the generalization. So you can have, in general, you can have any sort of grading matrix here.
Is there a consensus relation on the...
Right. Okay, so I'm not going to be able to remember all the definitions, so I don't want to get too much into it, but one of the things, of course, is that you have sort of a generalized inverse, which is the antipode, and then, of course, you need to know how, you also have to have a rule for if you have two, such a thing like a tensor product, you need to have a rule for multiplying them together, and this is the consistency condition such that the co-product and then the inverse and the multiplication has to be essentially equal to the identity. So if I split things, I take the inverse of one, if I multiply them together, I should just get the identity back, and that's what this and that's why I'm saying that if you do have a non-trivial co-product and you choose sort of a canonical choice for the identity such that, so here's the sort of the standard choice. If I have x, which is an element of my algebra, my co-unit should take all of my algebra elements just to zero except for the identity. And then similarly, the unit is just something that maps from the field into the algebra, so it should just map the identity into the identity of my algebra. And so this is just saying that multiplication and the co-product are consistent with the definition of the inverse. Okay, I don't want to, I'm not going to be able to remember too carefully.
What's the benefit of having the Hopf structure?
Okay, well, so first of all, it's there. I mean, there is a non-trivial co-product, so I don't know whether there's any advantage to it or not. The advantage of having identified it is that there's been a lot of study into these things. They arise in in the study of quantum groups, and where you can, so there's a large amount known about them, and often once you point at some of these structures, you can find sort of other restrictive conditions that follow from them, which in particular can help you identify what the S matrix is. Exactly. And so one of the things that I'll try and give sort of a little bit of the argument for is that you don't expect the actual coproduct to take. So here I essentially just pointed out at tree level, but you don't expect it to take any quantum corrections. So although that's more of the argument for that is somewhat hand wavy. Okay. So after that, the point is that you can just go ahead and calculate what the T matrix is, and so here are the explicit expressions for these elements, and in particular they involve this A, which is the sort of the gauge choice, and this is just, as I said, related to the fact that the T matrix is not a gauge invariant object. And then you can check whether, now that you've calculated it and identified this coproduct, whether indeed all your expectations are satisfied. So here, now again, as I said, I'm only working to tree level, so we can take the approximate values, or sort of the expansion and powers of fields for our charges. So here is an expression for these charges. And the example here is in terms of creation and annihilation operators, and here is the central charge, which, as I said, is just proportional to the momentum of our excitations. And this is the algebra that we use. This is this normal PSU 2 bar 2 algebra that we expect the excitations to satisfy. And as I said, the S matrix should satisfy this intertwiner condition. So essentially this is just to say that the S matrix should commute with the action of the charges. But in this case, I've included the non-trivial coproduct. This is just corresponds to saying that, so that the tree level approximation to this is just that the T matrix should commute with the charges up to these additional terms, which are proportional to B. B, as I said, this curly P, which is just proportional to the Wilson momentum. And indeed, just after a little bit of a kind of trivial checking or tedious checking, you can indeed check that these relations are satisfied. Furthermore, as I said, you expect that there should be no particle production. So here is the 2 goes to 4 scattering amplitude. So you can just sum up the various different diagrams that you have. You also have a contribution from a 6-point vertex, and indeed they are 0. This absence of particle production is actually the equivalent statement to saying that scattering is factorized. And if you just take one of these legs and sort of bend it back, you can again show that these diagrams will cancel each other, except for the particular case where this internal leg kind of goes on a shell, where you get a delta function, you just take the principal value, and indeed this just says that you find that you get a delta function which says that your incoming states have to have exactly the same momentum as your outgoing states, which is the same as saying that the scattering is factorized. And then finally, you can check that the T matrix does satisfy the classical Yang-Maxwell equation. So that's the world sheet calculation, and so indeed the expectations we have that the theories that satisfies the normal integrable descriptions is satisfied, but we want to check that we get agreement with the S matrix calculated on the gauge matrix.
So this factorization, was it three levels?
And again, also as you can see, yeah, three levels. They're all three level diagrams. Maybe one thing that's a little bit. I mean, here the vertices. There's a sort of a mixing up of parameters, and for example, here, as I said, well, it's a tree-level result. Okay, so just very, very quickly to introduce, what I mean by the S matrix on the gauge theory side, we can consider the N equals 4 gauge theory, and we can consider the anomalous dimension. We want to find the anomalous. There's a matrix problem where the anomalous dimension operator is just we want to find the eigenvalues acting on operators which are located at the origin. And as the sort of canonical or simplest example, if we can just consider single trace operators made of large numbers of z's, which is some scalar of purity, which are called w, we find that one loop of the anomalous dimension operator is related just to the simple Heisenberg spin chain, the Hamiltonian for the Heisenberg spin chain. And so this is, and so here this operator is we've identified, say, the where we identified the z's as the spin up and the w's as the spin down. This sort of nice picture of what we mean by a spin chain in gauge theory. And in particular, there is this sort of the extent of the string, the 1+1 dimension issue is that is the fact that the extent is just the length of the trace. It's nothing to do with the four-dimensional space-time of the theory. Okay. We can focus on a spin chain with SU2 bar 3 symmetry. This just arises as a subsector of the full theory, where we look at each of, instead of just allowing our fields to take, or allowing our impurities to be a single W, they can take any value of phi 1, phi 2, just two bosonic directions, or any two fermionic directions, or two of these fermionic directions. But again, we choose our vacuum to be this scalar Z. In this case, the Hamiltonian, or the anomalous or the dimension operator, actually lies inside the algebra of SU2 bar 3. It's an element of the algebra itself. It doesn't commute. Oh, sorry, it does form. It forms a central element of the right. Yes. It lies in this SU2 3 subsector of the full algebra. Okay. You can then construct the Hamiltonian in perturbation theory. Some reasonable number of like 1, 2, 3 loops for certain sectors. There's been confirmation of integrability, at least at low orders, and I guess that the best at the moment is that there's some evidence that integrability persists to 4 loops in the gauge theory. And a couple of things, the Hamiltonian at higher loops is long range, so here at one loop, the Hamiltonian just is the nearest neighbors, but at higher loops, the interactions involve larger numbers of spin or block of lattice sites, with the maximum length being the sort of the order of that picture work. Okay. Also, the action is dynamic. The generators can change the number of spin sites. The origin of this just lies from the fact that the simple supersymmetry variation of the fermion involves the commutators of fields. So where these are sort of your lattice sites, you can take a single fermion into to two sites. You change the size, the length of your lattice. We define a vacuum state to be a large number of these, one of our scalars, in this case z. And initially, we just ignore the fact that we have a trace, right? We want to consider sort of asymptotic states, so we just ignore the fact that we have a trace, and then at the end, of course, we have to impose periodicity. So we just consider it sort of infinitely long states. And once we've chosen our vacuum, the remaining excitations of these two bosons and two fermions, and the symmetries which preserve the number of excitations is this SU2 bar 2. In fact, you can actually show that the full S matrix will again be the product of two of these SU2 bar 2s with shared central charge. The tiltation operators is the central charge shared by these two supergroups. Okay. Right. So on the gauge theory side, you can then look at the representation theory, and this is done by very nice work by Beiser. You can study the representation theory of the group, and you can find that the representations, the appropriate representation for SU2 2, can only have half integer valued anomalous dimensions. Dimensions. But of course, that's not right. For anomalous dimensions, you want it to vary continuously with the value of your coupling constant. And so it was necessary to add in these additional central charges, which again are expected to vanish when evaluating on physical states. And after you do this, you can then, with respect to this extended algebra, you find that the states with, single impurities are still BPS, and you can use this symmetry algebra to determine what the eigenvalues of the dilatation operator for these asymptotic states for a single excitation up to a single arbitrary function of the coupling. So using just the representation theory of the algebra, you can determine what the eigenvalues of the dilatation operator are, and you get this sort of square root dependence and the sine squared of the excitation momentum. this is where the sort of Fourier transform, if the single trace is sort of an extension and it gives you an extra coordinate, you get Fourier transform so that you get this, you get momentum of excitations. Okay, so the next thing you want, of course, is you want to talk about the S matrix, which just takes two excitations on your, again, you have a trace, you have some number of impurities, and you just want to take what happens when you, you know, take them past each other. And the S matrix just describes what occurs when you take them past each other. And then once you've determined the S matrix, you can determine, you can evaluate what the spectrum of the anomalous dimensions is just from the beta equations. The beta equations are just the imposing periodic boundary conditions on your spin chain. This is very schematic, in fact, because you have the S matrix is a is indeed a matrix, because you have different flavors, and you actually get this sort of nested set of equations, which is very messy. But schematically, it just says that if you take a single impurity and you bring it around your spin chain, as you scatter off each one, you pick up a phase, which is given by S. And of course, you only need to worry about two particle interactions because of the stability. And at the end, as you take your particle all the way around, of course, it should just be equal to the phase that you just pick up by bringing around a distance L. And this then just says that the two things should be the same. Okay. Right, so the so here's the action of the symmetry algebra on the actual states. And then importantly, you find that some of the symmetry generators change the length, as I said. So you have these Z plus or minus, which just correspond to, you know, annihilating or creating a vacuum state. And again, you can write your S matrix in terms of these arbitrary functions. And as I said, a key point is that once you've Fourier transformed, if you want to take these creation and annihilation operators past one of your impurities, you pick up a phase. So when you look at the action of the S matrix on two particle states, which itself, you know, you can scatter, say, two bosons into two fermions, which you annihilate one of your vacuum states. If you look at what happens, if you look at the action then of one of your generators on two particle states, you find this similar, it doesn't satisfy this normal Leibniz rule because of, you know, insert these z plus or minuses. So then when you go on to calculate the commutator of the q's, of the generators with the S matrix, you find that you need to use this non-trivial coprobe. Again, just accept this for this reason that you have these length changing operators. Okay, so I guess the last thing I'll just sort of one last thing. We want to try and find what the appropriate limit is of this S matrix is, so that we can compare it with the world sheet calculation. And one of the very nice things is that just by using this symmetry algebra, we can relate all of these coefficients to each other. So that at the end, there's only sort of, even just using the symmetries, there's only one undetermined factor, which is this overall phase, which I'm going to call S0. So, as I said, we want to take the appropriate limit of the gauge theory answer and compare it with the world sheet calculation. And as I said, the world sheet length is proportional to the p minus, which is the longitudinal momentum. And the loop counting parameter is this 2 pi over the square root lambda. The spin chain length is given by, it's given by the length of our vacuum, which is just the R charge J, plus, and then there's a small thing related to the number of impurities. The different fields will carry various charges, and so they can, in some sense, the length of the chain is not directly related, or is not exactly equal to the R charge of the state. There's a small factor, but if we're only interested in, as I said, like large asymptotic states and small numbers of impurities, this is essentially an order one effect. But it's important. I mean, and we will show up. I mean, it's just a but just a kind of first order. If we want to, for the choice where we chose the world sheet length or the world sheet, we chose a gauge choice such that our momentum was equal to the angular momentum J. So that in this case, if we want to identify the world sheet length with the spin chain length, we need to multiply all our parameters by 2 pi over square root lambda. In particular, if we take our spin chain momentum and we want to relate it to our string momentum, we have to multiply it by this factor. So what we can do is we can just rescale and then, as I said, expand in powers of this parameter, which just corresponds to scaling our momentum to be zero while we take the coupling constant to be large, while we keep this particular combination lambda times the momentum squared fixed. So after taking, so we take this particular limit on our S matrix elements, as I said, as an example, here's just the element which scatters two bosons into two bosons. So it takes two bosons into the symmetric combination, and it's determined up to an overall phase, which we can relate or we can parameterize by this function theta. And here is, as I said, the definition. The expressions are a little bit complicated, but if we choose a particular choice of this theta as that of AFS, which reproduces the semi-classical string spectrum, so this overall phase is not determined by the symmetries by demanding that the S matrix satisfy commute with these symmetries, and so there's this overall functional degree of freedom. There are some restrictions on it, such as crossing symmetry and so on. And of course, in the end, wanting to actually match with the anomalous dimensions of specific operators. So using this, there's a couple of choices. AFS, one particular conjecture. And if we choose the string gauge to be in this constant J gauge, and particularly set A equal to 0, we find, so this is the explicit expression for this theta. And so here's the resulting gauge theory answer. And here's the string theory answer. And for the appropriate choice of A equals to 0, we find that these two terms match, these terms match, and we just have this remaining term, which is as I said, I factored out an overall factor of this term. So it really is just linear in momenta. And this term is related just to this difference in definition, as I said, on the string length. Even after this rescaling, the string length is J, and there's this sort of order 1 term M, and you can show that at least in the rank 1 sectors, these additional terms, which are linear momentum, are exactly related to that difference.
Which order is the question theory, please?
Sorry, what?
In the gauge theory, this is the answer to which order is the question theory?
Okay, so this is the answer to, so it's all orders in lambda, but it's all orders in lambda, but, okay, so. All of these answers are to all order lambda. There's various different conjectures of what this overall factor should be. So the answer should be all orders in lambda. However, you have to take the length of your, so at a given order in lambda, the length of your operator has to be larger than the order in lambda which you're considering. So it doesn't include kind of short, you can't, so at high orders in lambda, you can't consider short operators.
But this one is dependent, yeah. So the
answer is lambda independent? Oh, no. Okay, so this, I see. So here, this is the part of the, I've expanded the gauge theory answer first of all, the expression for the end. So this is the gauge theory answer expanded such that lambda is large, but lambda p squared is fixed. It will actually depend on lambda. In particular, the actual exact expressions for the energy look like the square root of 1 plus lambda p squared. But in some sense, this is the small momentum limit of the exact gauge theory answer.
Sorry, remind me what the parameter A is, little a.
Okay, so we chose a sort of a different, a sort of an interpolating light cone gauge on the world sheet so that the light cone momentum looks like 1 minus A P plus A times J. So this was our gauge choice.
So A is a parameter you can set. So just say that you could set A equals a half and then just have P minus P prime squared is the answer.
Sorry, say that again?
A equals a half and kill off the first term.
Exactly. So if you actually, so there is a different choice, as you said, if you set A equals to a half, and this just corresponds to choosing for your overall phase, choosing for this overall phase to be a particularly simple function, which just looks like e to the I of p minus p prime, And in this case, if you then calculate the spectrum, you actually find that, so this gives you a particularly appealing choice for just for the S matrix, but if you actually want to calculate the spectrum, you'll find that for A being a half, when you want to calculate the exact expressions for the energy, you find that you have to, well, the expression for the energy in terms of the moment ends up being a little bit more complicated. And so the spectrum will look the same, but the S matrix looks similar. OK, so I guess I've basically run out of time. So you can try and calculate quantum corrections. In this case, the Lagrangian starts to look a bit worse, or you have to include higher terms. You can calculate the corrections to the one-loop propagator. And indeed, you find that when you include the fermions and the bosons, it all works out very nice, and the correction is zero. If you try to calculate the one-loop corrections to the four-point function, you unfortunately find these divergences, which are these logarithmic divergences plus finite terms, which of course would be the terms that you're actually interested in, but you can't find. Well, it seems pointless to exactly study them until you've understood what is the origin of these divergences. One particular way the nicest way of writing them is in terms of a contribution to the effective action. So here we're just looking at the scattering of two bosons into two bosons. And this is the divergent contribution to the effective action. This term here is just related to a simple wave function normalization of your fields, but then you find this sort of determinant looking like extra term, and it's somewhat hard to explain exactly what the origin of it is. There's various different ways that you can try and interpret it or try and remove it, and so far none of these have proven exactly to have worked. Given that that's the case, as I said, it's perhaps worthwhile to try and study a simpler model. In this case, the sigma model on the supergroup manifold. But I think I'm just going to skip this so that, I mean, it's somewhat illuminating, but doesn't exactly lead directly to a solution and has some issues of its own. Okay. So then, just to summarize. So as I said, by studying the S matrix in this light cone physical gauge, we can try and make kind of a comparison between the close comparison between the world sheet theory in the bulk space time and the S matrix that we calculate in the gauge theory in the spin chain description. There's a number of issues, in particular trying to understand this Hopf algebra structure and exactly what it tells us about the theory. It's very useful in well-known integral systems to give a very kind of powerful description of the system. Exactly what the use of it is in the case at hand is not necessarily clear to me at the moment, but I guess there's reasonable hope that it will be similarly useful in this case. Actually understanding how it arises and what it actually means, I would say maybe not just in light cone gauge, but maybe in, say, other covariant gauges where you have other issues, but you should be able to see the same structure, though in a very different fashion. This is one thing. One huge issue is to try and to push this to include one loop and to try and understand these divergences that seem to occur. I mean, obviously, the theory should be finite and should be sensible. I mean, this remains a very pressing issue. And then finally, as I said, trying to understand the theory in, say, a more covariant gauge. In covariant gauge, the light cone gauge is not Lorentz invariant. It's not 1 plus 1 dimensionally Lorentz invariant, which means a lot of the normal things that you sort of do in integral models don't work very well. And so, however, if you went to a covariant gauge, then you could use a lot more of those techniques. Of course, that brings in some of its own problems. In particular, it might be necessary to use something like the Berkowitz formulas and whatnot, which can be complicated. And also, additionally, if you do go to a covariant gauge and you include the longitudinal degrees of freedom, it's not clear how to interpret those on the gauge theory side. So in that case, you would have some sort of nested beta equations, which now include scattering between ghosts and longitudinal degrees of freedom, and you would have to find some sort of way to decouple those. So that also remains sort of an open problem. Okay, thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
So, looking up Trigall and going to higher orders, what are the expansion factor again?
So, the expansion is an inverse Council lambda.
So, I thought for the case, I mean, even were a BES, so we're determining the scanning phase in terms of lambda. At lambda equals the infinity is there is an essential similarity. So I don't understand. So how you can be consistent?
Okay. So a couple of things. The BDS S matrix is certainly not one for a start. Okay, it has to be certainly that we have to model. I mean, we definitely know that BDS doesn't.
I was talking about BES.
Oh, BES. Ah, okay. Right. I see. So in that case, then this. So from the point of view of the world sheet theory, doing this perturbation expansion should be a perfectly sensible procedure, right? I mean, if the theory is okay. Now, it's true that you do seem to find these singularities when you expand these exact objectives for the S matrix, and I don't have a good answer for how that issue is meant to be resolved. I will say that in that case, the answer that they conjecture is so it's this sort of asymptotic expansion. And so in that sense, that expansion is not particularly well defined, and I think there probably remains to be some sort of understanding of how to actually resum it and express it in the user. Right. So yeah, I guess so. Okay, I don't have a good answer other than to say is that I think the understanding of even that conjectured exact S matrix is partial. Yeah.
Also, one question.
Sure.
When you try to change the order of operator, you see the breaking term appearing. That means also for the case where parameters are space like accelerating. I mean, that if you change it, you will see the.
Yes, okay. That's right. They do, yes. So, yeah, it's where they're space like separation.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So, do you have a Popper infrastructure on the.
Yeah, no, I mean, in some sense, the Hopf algebra structure arises more naturally or more obviously on the gauge theory side. If you excuse me getting the actual, say, factors wrong, which I started, like the signs wrong, but it just, so if we say have some, so if I'm going to consider, say, this just looks like, you know, this is the source of state, and I want to consider what, say, Q is on psi prime. I can just use the standard definition for what this is on the one particle state, so I get some coefficient of chi double prime C plus chi prime plus some other coefficient chi. Plus. So I get something which looks like this. Now the thing is that this I can just reabsorb into the vacuum, right? As I said, I'm considering infinitely long states anyway, so this is just essentially what I want to do is I want to rewrite this in the space of, you know, these two particle states. This one though is a little bit trickier. I can't just absorb this into the vacuum because it essentially changes that. You know, if I want to consider the length between these things. So there's a rule that if you write down what the expression for these things is, I can. This corresponds, gives me a term which looks like the momentum of this excitation times. So I get something like this. So basically, that just says that. Oh, wait. But I get this sort of phase. So it essentially doesn't just act, you know. This is the same thing saying I have an optical
problem. So I think the last equation just is that you shift it. So you have a really circular.
Okay. Well, no, so
cyclic structure because of the trace, and so when you shift it, you get some momentum. But
no. So this here doesn't arise. Doesn't arise. You know, we don't know.
Oh, yeah.
No,
just the example. How?
Okay.
So what happens when they
commute the? Why does this happen? Is that what you're?
Yeah, right.
Okay. So let me see if I. Okay, I'm probably gonna get this. So this state is given by E T I L P trace of Z L. Chi, Z, L minus, I guess, J. Okay. Yeah, I'm probably not going to be able to get all the things right. So if I consider this thing, this in terms of, yeah, right. So in order to, yeah, you can see it, okay, good. It's hard for me to see it here. My brain moving too fast. But exactly, this is the thing, we'll pick up an extra factor of anything. So this sort of, this thing sort of more naturally appears in the gate theory. You can,
Is there a use of that for the gate theory
itself? So is there a use? I can't think about a paper where someone has gone, we use this structure to make this prediction. One of the reasons for this is actually the S matrix in this case is normally when you have the hop algebra structure, you can use that to determine the S matrix of this overall space. However, in the case at hand, that's not actually necessary. The representation theory of this group is such that you don't need to use this more complicated. So at the moment, no. But that's not to say that there isn't.
The meaning from this structure is that you can compare. It gives you more evidence for the correspondence between
the two. Oh, okay. No, I mean, so for one thing, is that. You expect the S matrix to commute with the symmetries. In order for that, you have to notice that there is a non-trivial hop. If you just try and calculate the commutator of your S matrix with symmetries, you won't get the right answer. So it's not so much that there's a use, but it's necessary. I mean, and so here
necessary for integrality? Necessary for
it's not necessary. It is there. It is a fact of. You know, when you, you know what I mean? Like, if you want to calculate anything, you have to notice that in taking this, you have to stick in these extra phases. If you try to ignore them, then when you calculate the commutator of the Qs with the S matrix, it won't commute, or it won't give zero. So that's similarly on the worldsheet theory, that if you want to calculate the commutator of the S matrix with the charges, you have to stick in. Don't stick them in. I'm just saying that there are these additional phases that you might not naively expect. That's all. Then as to, is there any use as I said, when you understand the structure of the theory and how the symmetries are realized, maybe, but there's more. This problem is by no means solved. I mean, for one thing, this S matrix is only asymptotically defined, as I said. It would be very nice to know what is the exact S matrix for finite length. Now, perhaps if you can determine the structure of the theory and how the symmetries are realized, maybe you can. I don't know. I am speculating wildly, but I'm just saying that the more you understand about the structure, then the perhaps the more you'll find.
So, also, on the side, we see that that's a change of change if we have the derivation of I. So, what is the corresponding phenomenon on the string theory side?
Well, okay, so there.
If you can do the Lyapunov connotation.
Yeah. So I guess I don't know if I want to say the let me see the. I mean, if I choose a basis of the anomalous dimension operator, so, you know, so I diagonalize it, then the anomalous dimension, the operator itself won't try, you know, it'll take length of a given length, which is, you know, the same length.
It'll be an interpretation of the analysis.
It'll be, right. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't know how to say, like, for example, if I take the S matrix into, so if I take a state, the S matrix, in, and I scatter it, and I get a state of a different length, I don't know how to say what exactly the analogous process is there. What I will say is that it seems that these length-changing operators, Z plus and minuses, can essentially be identified with the E to the I X minus operators. So in some sense, these operators look like length-changing operators. And the change in the length seems related to this non-trivial coproduct. But this is a very good question, and this is very important. Really, all I said was a tree level, where the identification of the states is, so if I want to include looper corrections, if I want to include higher loop corrections, then I'll probably need to understand how the actual finite length changing effects occur in the states themselves. But before I do that, just a normal simple perturbation theory. If I'm just doing first order perturbation theory, I'm only interested in the corrections, like the first correction to the Hamiltonian, and I take my zeroth order states. So essentially that was all, that's sort of the analogous statement of what I did here at tree level. I'm not interested in what the corrections to the states are. If I want to go to higher loops, I do need to realize exactly how the states are coming. And so that may be one of the issues about going to higher loops. And understanding that may be important. But it may also be just the simple case that it's possible to choose a different basis for your states. You know, you can, on the gate, in the sort of the spin chain description and the gate theory description, where the states themselves don't involve any length changing operator. So it seems, and all you can sort of transfer all of the effects of these length changing things into the S matrix itself.
Any more questions? Yeah, then let's thank the speaker again.